Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey everybody, welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here in the LA Hollywood studio. You guys, I just got to sit down for, geez, maybe a couple of hours with one of my heroes, Mr. Scott Aukerman. This was a very big deal for me. I was one of the few that have gone into a little bit nervous, but we actually talked for a bit before we recorded, which really helped. And I came to learn very quickly that he's a great dude and super nice and just a sweet, sweet guy. And we got to sit here and talk about, he let me go for a really long time, much longer than he said he had time for. We talked about music, which was great. We got to talk about his great podcast, Are You Talking U2 to Me? Are You Talking REM Remy? That he does with Adam Scott that you all know that I'm obsessed with. We got to talk about our similar backgrounds growing up as Baptist boys, and the beginnings of his career with Mr. Show, one of my early big comedy influences for me back in the day, and he was just the best guy. We got to talk about all the things that I wanted to cover, including his movie crush, the classic, perfect film from 1960 from writer and director Billy Wilder, The Apartment. With Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine and Fred McMurray. It was great. Couldn't have gone any better. Big thanks to Scott for coming on. And here we go with Scott Aukerman on The Apartment. It's remarkably consistent. You know, Josh and I have the advantage of not having to book guests.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of just like we're on autopilot at this point. We've got it so down.
I wish I could get there.
Very, very natural. But yeah, that is crazy. So you started in
April 30, 2009.
Yeah, I mean, that was literally when we started.
Yeah, crazy.
And, you know, the landscape back then was a lot different.
Nothing.
We're very lucky. I feel very fortunate.
Yeah, to get in that early, because it's so weird. I feel like numbers, like how we get numbers are due to just being around so long for whatever reason, in a way, you know?
I feel that way too.
Like sometimes I wonder how many of people of the actual numbers we get are listening, but I know they are because we track them and they press play. And they,
right.
But it used to just be subscriptions and that's how your numbers were, but I don't know. It's so crazy.
Yeah. I bet you guys get a little bit of what we get too, which is people, like we'll get emails from people that say, you know, I listened for 6 years and then just went away for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And now I'm back, and like it's so cool that you're still doing the same thing, and I've caught up with all the older episodes.
I feel like I'm like comedy is very important to people when they're young, I feel like.
Uh-huh.
And then people get families, and they start having less time, and comedy gets less important to them. So
yeah.
I think that my show is a little more like, and that's why I try to keep it current with like current comedians rather than just going back to the same well of people from 10
right.
years ago. But it's like I feel like it burns bright in people's loves for 2 or 3 years or something like that. And then they go away and new people come in, you know?
But yeah, that's true. And I'm sure you also get some of these emails that totally freak you out. Like I started listening when I was 10 and I, you know, I just got my master's
right,
and you guys were with me the whole time.
Like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so weird. Such a weird thing that we fell into.
I know. Well, but you, I mean, I truly fell into it in that I had no previous experience in entertainment.
Right.
Other than, you know, working as a PA
right.
on film sets, on TV commercials out here.
Right.
But you were already well established.
Yeah. I mean, I was doing my show as a hobby while I was writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I started out as a comedian. Here in LA, and I was performing a lot.
Right.
And I was performing, you know, several times a week. And
this is like mid-90s?
This is mid-90s. Uh-huh. I started in 95, July of 95. And so until I started working on Mr. Show, which was 97 or 98, maybe. 97. 8. All right. but I was performing a lot, you know, and then I got on Mr. Show, and those guys very nicely, because they knew I was a performer, said, hey, you know, you're going to be writing for us. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be writing for yourself. So don't write yourself into sketches. Don't,
right.
You know, I mean, we hired you because we like your voice, but this is writing for us. I feel like I took that and being like always wanting to be the A student, I was like, all right, I'm not performing anymore.
Uh-huh.
And
but you were on the show some.
They were very nicely like let me be on the show a lot.
Yeah.
But I didn't expect it. I was like, oh, these guys don't like me as a performer or don't want me to perform. Well, I'm just going to be a writer.
Right.
And then I had co-written this spec movie, this movie on spec that got very, very popular and got close to being made several times. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of segued into being just a writer and never performed really all that much anymore. And even when I started doing my live show at first at the M Bar and then the UCB Theater here in LA, Comedy Death Ray, I would just produce it and I wouldn't even like perform on it all that much.
Oh, really?
Maybe once a month. Maybe, huh. You know, it wasn't like, say, the Meltdown show with Kumail and Jonah where they were the hosts every week.
Right.
It truly was, I wanted to make it the best show every week that it could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, with me as a host, it's not going to be the best it can be. Like, I was tired of shows in LA where the hosts would, you know, force themselves to be on the show.
Right.
And be the dead spot that people were like, oh, okay,
uh-huh.
This person again. Every
right.
week we have to listen to this guy. So I had pretty much like not really performed at all for a while, but I missed it. And so I was sort of doing stand-up every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started doing the podcast because I was kind of irregularly doing characters on the morning show at this local radio station,
mm-hmm.
Indy 103.1. I was calling in and doing my most popular character was the guy who plays Spider-Man out in front of the Man's Chinese Theater.
I
forget what my name was, but I would do American Idol recaps every time. I would do Robin Williams and all this kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they just like gave me my own show. And said, hey, you know a lot of comedians and you're always calling in and doing the characters. Why don't you do your own show? So it became like a hobby where I was like, oh, I get to perform again.
Right.
And I was doing it for free. Mm-hmm. They weren't paying me. And we turned that into the podcast. And it just, you know, I started to see how popular podcasts were compared to people listening to radio.
Yeah.
You know. And so it really was just something, you know, like my career is sort of filled with all these things that I did just for fun
uh-huh.
that then turned into the main thing that I do, which is like really kind of strange. Between Two Ferns was that way.
So great.
Bang Bang, the REM show, you know, like we thought no one would listen to that.
Yeah.
The U2 show. So like all this stuff that I did, it was just like, hey, here's a dumb idea that no one will give a shit about.
Right.
Let's just do it. And then that became like the main thing.
Do you feel like, and I was talking just for the listeners with Scott about, I'm obsessed and I've talked a lot on the show about the REM show.
Oh, really?
And
thank you.
And just being obsessed with it.
But you were telling me before the show, you don't recommend it to anyone.
No. I recommend, like REM was, and you two were my guys as well.
Yeah.
And especially.
Are we the same age-ish?
I'm March 71.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm 29, but so I guess we're a little off. But
and we had similar upbringings too. With
that's a joke, by the way.
I know.
you gave me a look of confusion, which is not how people usually react to jokes.
I didn't get it till a second later. I grew up Baptist in a Southern Baptist house in Georgia.
Mm. I was born in Georgia, but moved to California.
Yeah, Savannah.
Yeah.
So you have, obviously you left very quickly, right?
Yeah, like 6 weeks after I was born.
Have you ever been back?
We filmed the Mr. Show movie in Atlanta, and then I've been to Atlanta a couple of times.
Gotcha. But not Savannah?
Not Savannah, no. Maybe during the Mr. Show movie? I can't remember.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think from listening to the REM show, your parents were a little more strict than mine. Mine weren't necessarily permissive. They were just obsessed with disliking each other. So I was sort of as the third.
That took up all their focus.
Basically, I was the third child, so I was kind of under the radar. But, you know, Southern Baptist upbringing is that I later sort of did a full 180 on. So I know that you can identify with that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was something that I think from age 13 through 20, even, I was still sort of wrestling with it a mm-hmm. little bit, you know, of
for sure.
You know, I remember going to camp when I was 13 or 14, and I had a girlfriend, and we were, you know, sort of like, you know, exploring
sure.
everything, you uh-huh. know, and kind of like praying really hard, like, yeah. please,
oh, yeah.
shouldn't I be a better person or something?
I know.
Yeah. And just all the way through like 20 when I lived at home until I was 20 and then I moved away to go to school. Mm-hmm. And so I had to go to church once or twice a week.
Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night.
Wednesday night would be the one until I was 18. But once I was 18, it was only Sunday morning, Sunday night.
Okay.
So, and then at a certain point, just Sunday morning. And then at a certain point, I also was like staying at a friend's house on Saturday night. So
right.
I wouldn't have to go to, you know, Sunday morning.
Were you in the other stuff like FCA or Young Life or any of those?
It was called Boys Brigade is okay. what I was in.
I've so heard of that one.
Maybe similar to what you're talking about. Just
sort of
like,
school affiliated Christian
school
groups.
Yeah. No, not school affiliated.
Okay.
No. But yeah, it was, and I was singing in church yeah. on Sunday mornings
I was in
and
the
stuff
choir.
Like that. Yeah. until I moved out. And so it was kind of one of those things where I was like, I think all these ideas are really interesting. And mm-hmm. I would talk to the youth pastors. We would go to lunch sometimes
yeah.
and I would talk about stuff and they'd go, oh, wow, you have a really interesting take on this. You
right.
know? But at a certain point I was just like, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. I think that kind of happened for me in college. I took a religion class where mm-hmm. we studied I think Judaism, Buddhism, and maybe Islam. I can't remember the third one. Or maybe it was Christianity. And that's when I was like, oh, wait a minute. These are sort of all the same story. How could that be?
Right, right. Yeah, it's, I don't know. The more you poke holes in it, I yeah. don't know. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. But hey,
right.
I also am of the opinion, really, with anything in the world, like if it makes you feel better, great.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't yeah, come yeah, down yeah. on people who, I'm not one of those atheists who's like, oh, you're so stupid if you
no.
believe in God. You know, I
same
just.
Same here. That's just pointless.
Even some things that are probably harmful, like Scientology or whatever, mm-hmm. or even Mormonism, I'm just like, you know what? Let people have whatever they can cling to in order
right.
to make themselves feel better about
yeah.
life. Although if it's crossing over not harming other people, I mean, that's how I sort of feel like about a lot of old people who get into Fox News or uh-huh, whatever. It's
right.
like, guys.
that
like,
religion.
That Yeah, exactly. But.
Where was I going, though, with the REM thing?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Well, we were talking about Georgia.
Not recommending it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Going to college when REM was, you know, 89 to 95 is when I was in Athens.
Yeah.
Told you I played on the softball team with Mike Mills.
Yeah.
Stipe was around.
How was he as a player?
He was okay.
How are you as a player?
I was good enough.
Mm-hmm.
You
sounds
know.
Like your team was dynamite.
I mean, it was
one okay guy, it was, one good enough guy.
It was bar league softball,
yeah.
so it was pretty low stakes. Mm-hmm. I remember he was very competitive and took it a little more seriously than the rest of us did.
Interesting.
And okay. I ended up hanging out with him one night about 5 years ago, Eugene Merman came through town, who's a friend, and he invited everyone out. Mike Mills was one of them, and I reminded him. I had a good time, but I reminded him about the softball years.
Oh, he
did not remember me.
He did not remember you. Oh,
no.
Interesting. Did he know who you were from what you do, or?
No.
Okay,
no.
Interesting.
He knew nothing of me, but he was a nice guy.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Why would he not remember you if you were on the same team?
I don't know, man. It was two full seasons.
Two seasons,
yeah.
too. It is tough when you meet so many people. Like,
yeah, I'm
when
sure.
your life becomes, as mine and Mike Mills have,
right?
just incredible. No, when you, especially if you're working on a lot of different things, like I'm sure,
yeah.
and going and traveling to a lot of different cities, it just like,
yeah.
it sort of becomes a blur where you see someone and go,
absolutely.
Who is that person? And then you look it up and go, oh, wow, for 6 months we were
right.
in constant contact.
yeah, once a week.
Yeah.
But yeah, those were my guys in college. And so when I started listening to the show, it was the perfect mix for me of, like legit REM stuff, which I love, and Adam Scott is just
super fan.
Yeah, and the dynamic between you guys is just so fun with him taking it so seriously. And
I mean,
sort
we set out to make a serious show. That's what's so strange
Come
about
on,
it.
Really?
We did the very first episode of U2, because the REM show originated as a show about U2. we went into it expecting to just literally super fan it and not do anything funny. And then
I got to go back and hear those.
I forget what happened, but somewhere within the first 2 minutes of the first episode, we started making jokes and it just became what it is. If you get us in a room together, we're just going to make those jokes.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just great. Renaming everyone and the way you guys get in and out of the sub episodes of, you know, are we talking, you know, is this an episode of Isle of Films or whatever? And I think the way, and that's part of why it works, is doing it the same every time. Like how quickly you get in and out of those bits, how one of you will say, oh, it sounds like it might be. Right. And then right afterward, how, you know, good up, good great up, good up.
Yep.
It's like this becomes this comforting thing somehow.
Yeah. It's interesting because when we came back with the REM version, we both are constantly trying to figure out new angles, you know what I mean? But at the same time, some people were sort of like, oh, the first episode of REM is a little fan service-y of like doing the same thing that we'd done in the U2 episode. And I don't know where I land on that. It's like, you can't just do totally new things. Essentially, although I started out as a comedian, I am, you know, growing up in LA and listening to a lot of LA radio, I became very fascinated with DJs and like broadcasting, you know, and Letterman started as a broadcaster and I was always, he was a hero of mine and I always thought that was very interesting. So I always paid a lot of attention to broadcasting and a lot of what he would do and a lot of what broadcasters do is you fit into a format and you sort of, you hit the same things all the time and that becomes comforting, you know, and to break out of that as a comedian is also something that you're striving to do as a comedian. So it's like, I feel like the REM show is a push and pull between us doing what we know works and then trying to get into weirder avenues as well that are new. But yeah.
Yeah. And well, you handle it very much like a DJ with the intros.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds very much like a sort of morning, not morning DJ necessarily, but sort of the classic DJ sound.
I think that it is interesting because, well, first of all, my voice, whenever I'm on a podcast and I'm doing a voice right now, sort of, but essentially in a conversation with me, I probably mumble more than when I'm on a show.
Right.
And I think when I started doing a podcast, Comedy Bang Bang, some of my friends were a little like, oh, is this your radio voice? And I'm like, no, I'm just trying to enunciate so that I can be understood. So like, as you can tell, I'm using my hands a lot, which I don't do in conversation all that much, you know, unless I get very animated about a topic.
Right.
But on the radio, just you need to make sure that people are understanding you. So I think it's a little bit of that. But yeah, I, you know, having the podcast company Earwolf, it was a little, I grew up being fascinated with broadcasting. So I sort of know all of those signposts that you have to hit of like introducing things right at the top and hyping things that are coming up and then how to go to a break and come back from it and all that kind of stuff that comedians in general don't really know how to do. So that was a big challenge with a lot of our early shows, you know, is training them of like how much information you have to give. So people aren't listening going like, what am I even listening to?
Yeah, it's a real skill. It's amazing how many people I've had on the show that are professionals that I've had to say, like, you know, you got to get on the mic a little more.
Right.
They'll just start talking like this and go out.
It drives me insane. Like, it happens all the time on my show. People will be like back here kind of doing this. And I'll go, you have headphones on. You can tell no one can hear
it's
you.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
It's very strange. I was on the flight from Sketchfest on the way down here today listening to the show. And I'm sure you don't, because you guys recorded it like a while ago, I'm sure.
Which one?
The REM stuff.
Oh, yeah. We did it last year or something like that.
Yeah. I'm sure you don't remember all the bits, but I rewound and had people staring at me for 10 minutes. It was when you did the mini episode on Kissing Styles. And you went,
no idea.
It was just the best because Adams was just like a mwah. And then you did this like 25-second
horrible noises
I don't even know what you were doing or how you're doing it, but it was just fucking fantastic.
Thank you. I don't know if you have the same experience, but I don't recall a lot of anything that I ever talk about on any show.
I totally get it, and I didn't want to be the guy that's like, oh, remember that one bit when you did Rochester and it was so funny.
Rochester is someone that I would like to bring back.
It's
though.
Pretty great. There's a little Tony Clifton in him. But,
Rochester?
Yeah.
Hi, Rochester?
Wait, you're from Rochester?
No, my name's Rochester.
So fucking good. Do you guys, I mean, I'm sure you just get in there and wing it, or are you actually?
We mainly wing it. The one thing that I would say we do on an REM show, well, okay, Comedy Bang Bang and REM are very different. Comedy Bang Bang, I totally wing.
Uh-huh.
All I ask, really? Yeah, all I ask from the people is what's your name and what's your occupation.
Right.
But for REM, we maybe will say, hey, the first segment is us just talking, and then second segment, let's talk about the record, and then the third segment, we'll do such and such, but that's it. Yeah, everything else is just winging it.
Okay, that's what I thought. It's great.
Thank you.
It's really the best. I can't wait to get into the U2 side, and I would love to hear a Smiths season three.
I would love to do a Smiths, one of my favorite bands.
Yeah.
But... yeah, who knows? I don't think Adam's ever listened to him. Trying to break through Adam's very narrow scope of what he listens to is really the only hard part of doing a sequel.
Well, one of the things I appreciate about you with music, too, is I don't think you're narrow, but you're very specific with what you like and you don't like. Mm. I guess REM, the perfect example, is basically getting to a point where you stopped listening to the new stuff.
I was so into them, and I love their early records so much that they changed their style so much, which is fine. I used to have, I think I tweeted this once about how bands that change their style totally should have to change their names. you know, so Weezer should have to call themselves something else.
Yeah, yeah. And, or U2 especially.
U2. But I've sort of, it's interesting because I heard a song from Up the other day.
That's the episode I'm on now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it was a Why Not Smile?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I landed on it on the actual episode, but I remember thinking that Up was just an exhausting record to listen to.
Yeah. Right?
But I heard that song and I was like, wow, this is really good. And I don't remember if I liked it on that episode or not. But there was a certain point with REM where they changed their style so much that I just didn't think it was what I liked out of REM anymore.
Yeah.
It happens with everything, with podcasts and everything. People will go like, oh, you're doing this new thing now and it's not hitting the same sort of like, you know, thing in my brain, which is releasing the,
sure, there's something
the pleasure
science.
Stimulus, you know. It's just not doing it for me, and that's why I like the show. I think it's perfectly valid on its own, but I wasn't willing to go there with them. And, and now I'm more appreciative of it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think even, and of course, I'm just now getting to the Up episode. You can even tell that Adam he's finding ways to like it rather than putting on Life's Rich Pageant and you don't have to do anything but like turn your ears on.
But I also truly think that Adam, because he likes a more narrow scope of music, I think he devoted the time to these records.
Yeah.
You know, so he knows them backwards and forwards because he listened to them so many times. And when I'm doing a REM episode or a U2 episode, I tend to do a lot of homework. That's the worst part about it is Adam knows all these things so much.
Right.
That he never has to do homework. He just like rolls into the studio and can talk at length about these records and he knows all the facts.
Yeah.
I do a lot of homework and I usually would listen to the records at least 10 times in various that week in various situations, blasting on my loudspeakers in the car. I would just try to listen to it in various types of situations.
That's a lot.
But I'm also just not appreciating it the way that he does, you know? So I think that he has a more nuanced understanding of the records than I do.
Yeah. Yeah. What was your, cause I think we kind of also had a similar entree into, lack of a better word, alternative music, which was eighth grade-ish INXS and The Cure and The Smiths. And
mine was probably,
like, what was your entree?
Mine, because I was really into Huey Lewis and the News.
Well, I was too.
Yeah. through even 85. I mean, Back to the Future is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah.
But I would say that I was so fucking stoked when Huey Lewis was doing the theme to that.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that he's in the movie.
Oh, it was amazing.
And that was just hitting all my sweet spots. Mm-hmm. So through 85, I think I was still kind of into pop music, and I listened to Kiss FM pretty much. which is a local radio station, which is like top 40, basically. Right.
But so, top 40 back then was really good.
That's the thing is like, real people who really like alternative music.
Yeah.
When I started to get into alternative music, I threw away all my supposed, you know, pop records.
Right.
I was like, these are bad. I'm into alternative music, but it was all like Huey Lewis and the News, The Cars.
Oh, fucking like, incredible.
Incredible records that I'm Hall & Oates and stuff like that.
Man.
I'm like, get these out of here.
It's all great.
So I became way less snobby about music, but my entree was, I think, Smith's Hatful of Hollow, probably.
Oh, really?
I think maybe Pretty in Pink. Is that where I first heard? It must have been where I first heard Please, Please, Please.
Yeah.
Or maybe I got Hatful of Hollow first, but that came out in 85, right? So.
Well, my entry to the Smiths was The Queen is Dead. So I was a little
that
later.
That would have been 86.
And
yeah.
I was a kid at church, gave me the cassette. He gave me that and he gave me Husker Du, Candy Apple Gray.
Okay.
And I had to kind of go backwards for both those bands.
Yeah. I had a best friend. That was really what it was. It was my sophomore year. I had a best friend who we hung out together all the time, and he was really into alternative music.
Uh-huh.
So he had Smith's posters, the Smiths, the Alarm, and REM.
Yeah.
Those were like the three that I can sort of tie back to him. You know what I mean? Where I don't think I would have listened to them without him. So, and I also had a different best friend. I guess I had two best friends, but one was drama and one was regular school.
Uh-huh.
But he was really into X and OMD and and all these things. So it was pretty much those two guys, I think, who really introduced me into things. But the Smiths really was like he was really cool, and I saw the Smiths poster on his record, and it was from the first record.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when I found Hatful of Hollow at Tower Records in on Beach Boulevard, it was $5.99 and it was a double record. And I was like, this is a fucking steal.
Yeah, totally.
And so I got it and just wore that record out.
Yeah.
And around that time, K-Rock, I started being able to get the signal on because I had like a FM, AM, FM hi-fi with a record player and a tape cassette.
Right.
And I could finally get the signal for like FM stations. You know what I mean?
And so funny to think about those days.
And so back in 85, K-Rock was playing like Prince next to, you know, all of these great alternative bands that I grew up with. But that's really where my alternative love sort of started, you know. And then I just went in deep and pushed. I was like all in on it. And then around 20, I was like rebuying all of my pop records.
Right. Well, it's interesting though, because I was, for me, it was Casey Kasem every Sunday after church, listening to the America's Top 40. And then MTV was hit me like a freight train, especially as a little Baptist kid.
Yeah.
I was glued to it. And when you look back at those early days of MTV, I didn't know.
You're wearing an MTV shirt right now.
I know. I wore this. The head of iHeart is Bob Pittman, who started MTV. So I brought it out here to suck up to him a little bit.
Okay, great.
But I had the chance to tell him when I met him in person. I was like, Mr. Pittman. I was like, I was your kid. I was
Did
that guy.
Did he have
guy.
Anything to do with it back in the early days?
No, he founded MTV.
He founded it.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
He started
MTV. I read the book, but I don't recall all the details.
Yeah, so I didn't know it at the time, but you know, if you're watching MTV in those days, you're watching like the Talking Heads, and you're watching
Billy Idol, Duran Duran,
all this stuff that ended up being kind of the entree into alternative. You just didn't really know it at the time.
I will say that in '83, I had a girlfriend that the one I was praying about when I was 13, who was really into she was really into X. And I would sit there, I would watch like Video One over at her house, which was the Richard Blade hosted like local video and TV show.
Yeah,
because we didn't have cable. I
didn't have cable until I was like 12 or 13.
Okay, I didn't have it until I was 15 in 85. So in order to see MTV, I had to go over to a friend's house.
Yeah.
So Video One or Friday Night Videos on NBC, those were the ones that you could see all these videos for. But Friday Night Videos was a little more commercial, so it was like Phil Collins and stuff like that.
Right.
Whereas Video One was alternative. So it was like, you know, Hazy Fantasy, Talking Heads, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that was really, I think, Oingo Boingo. Those were the first bands, alternative bands, where I was like, oh, this is really interesting and weird. And she and my girlfriend really likes them. She was also into Springsteen, which I, at the time, could never really figure out because she was basically, I think she was into whatever Robert Hilburn at the LA Times wrote about, you know, right. which is another like Adam Scott mainstay. He would always read Robert Hilburn reviews, but it was like whatever he talked about, she was into. But yeah, I think 80, between 83 and 85, I was sort of figuring it out. And then from 85 on, I was like totally into it where I was like, anything commercial sucks.
Yeah. It's cool to go through. Cause I started out on like, Billy Joel and was just a fanatic as a kid. And that's the first time I ever drove a car was to a Billy Joel concert when I was 16. And
oh, wow.
there were many years where like you had to keep that quiet. But yeah. then you age back into like,
well, especially
fucking, who cares?
You were 16 and 86 or I mean,
87,
87. I mean, that was when he was, it's like that Stormfront
and, really bad.
A one, a two, a one, two, three, four.
It's like the least cool count in to any song in history, probably.
Yeah. Those were bad Billy Joel years.
Yeah.
A lot of reverb.
Yeah. And
have you gotten to the Stained Glass 2 episode, by the way?
No.
I would say don't listen to that, but go backwards and listen to Stained Glass 1.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because Stained Glass 1 is... That's Todd Glass. Uh-huh. That's Stained Glass 1 is in the U2 section.
All right.
Those really need to be listened to subsequently.
Is there a Billy Joel thread in there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I will spoil no more of it for you, but when you get to that episode, just... They're not connected to REM or U2.
Yeah.
Tangentially they are, but go backwards, listen to Stained Glass 1 first, and then listen to Stained Glass 2.
Well, but you could have such a disparate taste back then. Like, my first concert ever was Cheap Trick. Worship those guys.
Awesome.
But I was also listening to Billy Joel, and because I was from the South, I had this, looking back, these rednecks in the youth group that, you know, I was listening to fucking Alabama.
Right.
And stuff like that. And Hank Williams Jr. Mm-hmm. And
Leonard Skinner or?
Well, I have a brother-in-law who dated my sister at the time from high school on, and he was giving me.
Wait, he's a brother-in-law. Oh, so he.
Yeah, he started dating my sister in high school. Yeah.
Okay.
So he was feeding me.
I had a brother-in-law who was dating my sister at the time.
Pretty weird arrangement.
Is that how you become a brother-in-law?
But he was feeding me a steady diet of Leonard Skinner and Allman Brothers and Blackfoot and Atlanta Rhythm Section.
Oh, cool.
And all the stuff that I still love, all that stuff. The thing I truly left in the rearview mirror was like Alabama and Hank Williams Jr.
Yeah, I guess I haven't really. I went back and did a real Southern rock deep dive a few years back and started to get really into it. But Alabama is something that I haven't really crossed.
I mean,
you're
a California kid. So. Yeah.
But I will say that my brother and I just argued about music all the time. And he was into heavy metal and Rush and prog and stuff like that. And
right.
And it's stuff that I like now. I think I wish I had been a little more open to it back then where I was, where I could be a little more like, oh, that's cool. And I remember him like showing me Rush albums and showing me all the intricacies of it.
Yeah.
And me just going like, oh, this is stupid.
Right.
And now I think it's cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think now I'm sort of a person who's just like, I can find good in kind of almost any style of music. And when I throw on iTunes, basically I have like 250,000 songs in my iTunes or something. I just put it on shuffle and, you know,
probably
like,
pretty crazy.
Yeah. Just, you know, lounge stuff coming up next to, you know, Subhumans and, you know.
And then there's Elliot Smith and then Motley Crue.
Elliot
maybe
Smith
not.
I saw in a little tiny, like a bookstore here in LA before anyone knew who he was, because I was dating a girl who was like, oh, I think you'd like this guy, Elliot Smith. And I went in and saw like with 30 people, him just with an acoustic guitar. And I was like, then he became my favorite. I was like telling everyone, Elliot Smith.
God, he was the best. I was, when I lived out here, it was when he put out, Figure Eight, and I lived right around the corner from the, you know, the building of the album cover. And I was like, oh my God. And I saw him a few times with the band, but I got to see one acoustic show at Spaceland where I got to see that like quintessential Elliot Smith on a stool. It was just fantastic.
It was great. Unfortunately, I also saw the other quintessential Elliot Smith on a stool where he was too high to do a show.
Really?
Yeah. Those were so depressing.
Yeah.
I've seen a couple of people too high to do a show, and it's just
who else?
I know we're not supposed to talk about him anymore, but Ryan Adams.
I saw one of the Wiltern
shows I've ever seen.
Really,
where he just was on. He kept talking about like what a great night it was going to be. He's like has a whole album he's recording. He's going to play every song from it.
Yeah,
And all he would do is he would talk for 10 minutes in between every show about what he was going to do that night.
Yeah.
And then he hardly played any songs. And it was just like,
I was really into him. And some of this sort of makes sense now because I saw him a couple of times back then and he just seemed kind of like an asshole.
Yeah.
And then, when all this other
maybe
stuff
he
came
is.
Out,
yeah.
He's, who knows? Who
he's
can tell?
Proven to be. I don't want to keep you too late, so maybe we
keep
should
me
go
here
ahead
as
and,
long as you want.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about Mr. Show before we get into the apartment, because it was.
I pitched an apartment sketch on Mr. Show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we didn't. We never ended. I don't think I ever wrote it. Even
would it have been like one of the black and white type of things, or
we would have shot it in black and white if we had ever if I had ever written it. I don't think I wrote it. It was we. I remember at the time, I forget why it was in the news, but the Pope's apartment was in the news. Like the fact that he had an apartment.
I see where this is headed.
And so I was like, hey, what if we did a sketch about right. the Pope's apartment where all the bishops are like bringing in the little boys
oh,
to have
God.
Sex with? And Bob and Dave were like, write it up.
Yeah.
And who know? I mean, it was one of those pitches where maybe it didn't have legs or whatever, or I couldn't, you know, I did that show when I was very young and not that smart.
Yeah. How old were you then?
27.
Wow. That's crazy. And you came in not at the very beginning, right?
No. Well, not really. I mean, I was there. I was around from the very beginning. Actually, the first time I ever did comedy was the summer, July of 95. And it was because, I was in theater and I had written a lot of plays and I moved back here to LA and I was, my friend and I had written this pilot, which was like trying to be a better 90210 essentially with like interesting scenes and funny scenes. It was basically when the OC got on the air, I was like, oh, that's sort of what I was going for.
Oh, wow.
But you know, it was okay. And I, you know, we showed it to some people and some people liked it, but you know, I didn't know how to break into the business or whatever.
Right.
But I remember I had a friend who moved down here that I was in a show with up in Sacramento who I showed it to. And she was just like, she called me. I remember being in my apartment in Azusa and her calling me and going like, okay, I read your script. It's bad. I hate it.
Oh no.
And I was like, okay. She goes, but you're so funny. Like you're such a funny guy around, you know, when I hang out with you,
yeah.
Have you ever tried doing comedy? She goes, I have a roommate who is in comedy and, you know, like, and I had known that because a couple of times she'd invited me to some things. And I remember I'd gone to a party and I talked to this guy for a while and he was like, oh, you're a writer. Oh, cool. What have you written?
I know who that is.
Yeah. And it was Bob Odenkirk. And I talked to him for a while and he gave me his card and a flyer for like a show that was coming
out. Oh, cool.
So she's like, why don't you do this show? My friends have this show at the Comedy Store. Why don't you do this show? And just, you know, I think you could be really funny if you tried comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So her roommate, whom I had picked up at the airport when she moved here to LA and drove to my friend's house, was Karen Kilgariff.
Oh, nice.
And so that's how they were like friends from Sacramento.
Uh-huh.
And so that's how my friend knew all these comedians, right?
Right.
So The person with the show was Marilyn Rice Cub and CJ Arabia. They both did the show at the Comedy Store on Sunday nights called Windows 95. So I just tried it out. But weirdly enough, back to your original thing was she asked me to do it. And then so I was like, okay. And then that week I went to go see Bob and David's live show because of that flyer that Bob had given me.
Was this when they were like in a restaurant?
They were at a place called the Upfront in Santa Monica, which was like a real theater.
Okay.
That you could rent out. I did some shows there too, but the restaurant was a different place.
Okay.
Which I ended up performing with them a lot actually at that place. Yeah. And I saw Pulp perform at that place
well
too. Yeah. So, but I went to go see their show, which I think was called the Cross Odenkirk Problem at the time. Also all of HBO was in the audience and Bernie Brillstein was there and all and I knew who Bernie Brillstein was because I grew up fascinated with comedy and SNL and all and wanting to be on it and all that, but I just never knew how to do it.
Did you think that was something available to you though?
No.
Okay.
I couldn't figure out how to do it. I remember, so I loved Letterman.
Right.
And that was my main love, and I wanted to do something like Letterman.
Yeah, same.
But then I also, there wasn't a lot of, you know, this is pre-internet, so there wasn't a lot of, like, material you could read about stuff. So I remember reading a book about stand-up comedy.
Wow.
You know, and it had, like, interviews with Jerry Seinfeld and Richard Lewis and people like that, and it was like, oh, okay, maybe I should do stand-up comedy. Uh-huh. So I tried it when I was 18, and I was doing essentially like Jerry Seinfeld-style bits,
right.
Like observational bits, yeah. You know, about things. Have you ever seen this? You know, that kind of stuff. But then I never did it again. So I just kind of was like, I don't think I can do comedy. If I could ever audition for SNL, maybe I'd be good at it, but how do you even do that? And there was no UCB theater or anything like that in LA, so the Groundlings were there, but
right.
I went to go see their shows and I didn't like them all that much, and I was like, I just don't even know how to do it. And then I saw Bob and David do that show, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I know how to do it now.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, yeah, that's stuff that I do around the house.
Uh-huh.
I never knew you could do that as comedy.
So were you doing character stuff just for fun? And
it wasn't even character stuff. It was like just sort of like a type of humor that I did not think could be popular.
Yeah.
Where that went further than other types of humor in a way, you know, the fact that they were cursing a lot during their sketches was like sort of mind blowing, but just their subject matter.
Yeah.
And the way they approached the topics, I was like, I felt a real kinship to, because it was stuff that me and my friend would do to make each other laugh and our friends laugh, you know, around the house or around the restaurant we worked at. So I was like, oh, well, that's the type of stuff I'm interested in doing. So that combined with seeing an Andy Kaufman special that week, like a documentary about him, I was like, oh, let's do like an Andy Kaufman meets Bob and David type thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I did at the Comedy Store, and you know, the people who were at this show were like Bob and David, Janine Garofalo, Sarah Silverman, like all those types of people were there. Paul F. Tompkins, they were there every week. And I just fell in, you know, the first time went so well that Mary Lynn and CJ were like, oh, come back in 2 weeks and do another thing. And I just like never stopped.
That's
you know?
Cool.
Yeah, it was very, and Bob was there the second time that my friend and I performed at it, and he was like, hey, I have this show. Maybe you could write for it.
That's spot on, man. That's so good.
God damn it.
Yeah, that's the other Scott.
Yeah.
Or the other Bob.
Yeah, so it was just like one of these weird things. I was very fortunate in the sense of first of all, I just think, kind of, you know, Mr. Show, and it was a boys club. I mean, there was a sketch about it being a boys club.
Right.
It really was in a way.
But Karen was writing for them, right? Or no?
Karen never wrote, but no, we never had a female writer. Sarah,
oh, really?
Sarah was the one who was offered, but I feel she did that Dave Chappelle pop movie instead.
Right. I forgot about that.
But yeah, so I was sort of fortunate in the sense of like, you know, I was a white dude in LA, and I was also fortunate in the sense of like, it just didn't feel like there was as much competition back then.
Yeah.
As there is now.
Yeah.
There's so many funny people in LA, and they have a place to go to, you know, with the UCB theater. And now it's like, there's just too many funny people. You don't know how to.
I feel like that's kind of the case. It's hard to even parse it out now.
Yeah. But back then I was 25, and Bob was like, oh wow, yeah, I see a kinship between our senses of humor. And so he just really like adopted me and my friend in a way, and was in our sketch shows. If I ever had a sketch I wanted him to do, he'd be like, yeah, okay, and would come up and introduce them if he felt like the crowd needed pumping up. He was like Bob Odenkirk at the, and this is pre, you know, Breaking Bad. This is before he became Bob Odenkirk. But at the time around LA, it was like he was quality, you know? And so for him to come up and introduce a show and say that he endorsed it was, you know, a big deal. And so that's, you know, that's really, you know, how I got started.
It was such a special time. Just the collection of talent and everyone, it seems like, went on to do great things, and the way he and David were together, and just from the from Bob in the suit to Dave in the cargo shorts and the baseball cap, like the way they played off each other was just like, I can't imagine. Like, it's one of the great times in comedy, I think.
Yeah, it was really crazy. And we all hung out together every night.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, pre-cell phone, you had to...
Real hangs.
It was basically like you had to figure out where everyone was going that evening by a big phone chain.
Right.
You know, like who, you know...
Whose house we're going to be at?
Well, it wasn't even a house. It was like, what bar are you going to be at tonight?
Okay.
So, and that was always based around either a show that was happening, like, oh, okay, there's an alternative show that just started in Santa Monica at this place.
Right.
So we're all going to watch the show and then we'll hang out at the bar afterwards.
Yeah.
Or if there was no show, it was just like, what bar are we going to be at tonight?
Right.
And so around 2 p.m. or so, everyone would start sort of that phone chain and start calling up and going, what have you heard?
Yeah.
Where are we going to hang out? And I mean, that was back when you could talk to your friend on the phone for an hour.
I know.
You know? And so, yeah, it was really cool. And then we were just constantly in each other's shows. Mm-hmm. And it was like, if anyone said, hey, there's this fun thing, you'd go, yeah, okay, let's do it. If any of us had an idea, you'd go, okay, let's do it. And that's sort of translated to now where I feel like all the people from that era, I feel like I can kind of ask to do anything and they'll say yes. And I would say yes to them, you know? So I know that if I call up Patton Oswalt and say, hey, can you do a part in this thing? Or can you write me a blurb for this? Or can you be at this fundraiser or whatever? He'll say yes, or Bob or any of those people, you know, it's just, it really seems like something where we would do anything for each other.
That's
because
really
that's
cool.
What it was like back then.
Yeah.
We would do any of each other's shows.
That's
so
awesome.
Fun.
And everyone's just still in touch and tight enough.
I mean, there's always, it is interesting to me, the people who sort of fall away from it, you know. But yeah, I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that every single person who was ever involved, but the whole Mr. Show bond is such that, you know, Tom Kenny, for instance, who I maybe will see once every 2 years. Mm-hmm. Anytime I see him, we got to stop and you know, have a true conversation for a half hour about what's going on, because we have that Mr. Show bond.
Yeah.
You know?
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I mean, I was a kid in Georgia, so I didn't know. And I've talked about this on the show. I had no idea that world was available to people. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that could be a job. I didn't know that I could have moved to LA after college and tried to do stuff.
Surprisingly easy if you look at my life story. You just show up to a bar and Bob offers you a job.
That's great. So yeah, I had no idea. I mean, everything worked out in the end with my weird route my life took. But I always get jealous when I hear of people that had that experience of being here in their early 20s and sort of those salad days before it got too crowded.
It is. I mean, yeah. But you hear, I read sometimes about people who view like the Earwolf, the network that I started, the podcast network I started, the Comedy Bang Bang is on. People view that in the same way, in a way. They go like, oh, I just have, you know, it just seems like a magical place where everyone's hanging out together all the time. I would say the people younger than I probably are hanging out together all the time, you know, but the romanticism that people have when they think about those types of things.
As an outsider, yeah.
Some of it's true, some of it isn't. But for me starting out, it really was very romantic until kind of everyone started to fracture in the late 90s.
Yeah, it was just a special time. That between that and like the state, it was just sort of the birth of a new movement. This is not your parents' comedy.
Yeah.
Or not even your big brother's and your big sister's comedy.
It, you know, and I think everyone was sort of building on what had come before us, like Monty Python or the Kids in the Hall and stuff like that. I mean, that, you know, Comedy Bang Bang, the TV show, was really my love letter to comedy in a way. Like every one of the 110 episodes we did, I hope that people can tell, like, this is me saying, comedy, I love you.
Yeah.
From the people that I put in it. You know, I would sit there and have kind of a checklist of like, okay, we've had three of the kids in the hall on. Can we get the other two? Right. You know?
Yeah.
We've had SCTV is the only, we only had one person from SCTV. I was so bummed.
Oh, really?
Because everyone else turned us down.
Oh,
but,
no.
But Dave Thomas played my dad on it and was so great. But every other SCTV person was said no. But it was like that for me. It was just like, you know, I want to share my love of this art form that I've loved ever since I was a kid and sneaking looks at SNL late at night.
I had to sneak it too. It was not allowed.
Through Monty Python when I was 13
and
you know, the kids in the hall and everything. That's what Comedy Bang Bang, the TV show, was for me. Was, mm-hmm. you know, if you see Michael McKean in it, it's because...
Yeah, Mr. Mom.
No, Michael McKean.
Yeah,
not Michael. Michael Keaton would have been great on it. I think he turned it down. But if you see Michael McKean in it, it's not because I'm like, who's a good actor? Michael McKean.
Yeah.
It's because I fucking love Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
And he's only on it, I think, because of his comedy background.
Right.
And he, such a pleasure to work with. Like, I'd worked with him on Mr. Show, but Michael McKean doesn't need to do Comedy Bang Bang.
Yeah.
But he's doing it because of that bond that I think, and the chain of respect that I think comedians have for what came before and what comes after.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's why when I'm asked to do comedy things like someone's podcast or whatever, I usually try to do it because it's just that chain is very important to me.
Yeah. Have you seen Little Women, by the way?
Yeah.
I was Odenkirk is just one of those guys for me that it's really hard for me to.
I can't on Better Call Saul. Like, he's such a good actor that on Better Call Saul, I never think about. Oh, that's my friend that I've worked with for years and years. He's never think about it, but on Little Women, it was the minute he walked in, my wife and I burst out laughing.
Yeah,
like,
I didn't know he was in it, and so the same thing happened.
I'd forgotten, and then suddenly he was like, "Hello!"
it turned into a bit all of a sudden.
"Hello, daughters!"
Yeah,
and I was just like, I just started laughing. But he's really good in it. But
no, he did such a good job that I was able to forget that pretty quickly. Because he just sort of became this like kind of lovable dad.
Yeah.
But yeah, as soon as he walked on the screen, I was like, oh my God, I feel like I'm watching a sketch all of a sudden.
I think because it's period. Because Nebraska.
And he had those big mutton chops.
Yeah. Nebraska, I'm able to lose myself in. And
yeah, totally.
John Hamm is another guy who's a friend of mine who's like, I can lose myself in anything he's doing.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of the character, not him.
Uh-huh.
But that one was a tough one because it seemed like a Mr. Show sketch.
It totally did. It was great, though.
I love that movie.
And it was a fairly crowded theater, and I think I heard like seven or eight people kind of chuckle under their breath. Like,
yeah.
All right. I get it. Well, thanks for indulging that, man. I appreciate it. Maybe there'll be a Mr. Show movie one day, like the National Lampoon movie or something like that.
I mean, we really wanted to do... When I first started working on Mr. Show, they had a script called, was it called Hooray for America? I think it might have been.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and I remember we would do read-throughs of it, and I was always like, man, it's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. But then they were like, oh, no one will make this movie. It was all about Globochem taking over the world or something. And so then when we set out to make the Mr. Show movie, I remember the first 3 days Bob was gone because he had some other job.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was me, Brian, and David were the only people there. And we wrote so many scenes for it.
Uh-huh.
And they were all really, really funny. And then Bob came back and was like, I don't think these are too weird for... I don't think we can get this movie made. I think because of his experience with Hooray for America was too weird. So instead we went down this route of like trying to do he kept bringing up Adam Sandler, Happy Gilmore, like, well, the audience needs to really relate to the character, which then what was supposed to be a fun 6 weeks of writing a movie turned into 2 years of hell for us all.
No.
But at the same time, I don't think he was necessarily wrong about that. I think looking back, they never made Hooray for America. I don't think the world was ready for a true Mr. Show movie at the time. And I think now a place like Netflix would make something that was a little more like it. That said, if you go back and read the script to Hooray for America, because I think they published it, it's not that good. But
did you work on Run, Ronnie, Run?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was coming off of my season of Mr. Show that I wrote on. Bob and David said, hey, anyone who's a writer right now, do you want to write this movie with us? It'll just be a fun 6-week thing and then we're done. And only 5 of us said yes. Bob, David, Brian, myself, and BJ Porter. Mm-hmm. We were the only 5 who said, yeah, we want to do it. Everyone else was sick of it, so they left. And it just was the worst experience.
I liked it.
It's okay. It just is like watered down.
Yeah, I mean, to me. I don't know. I was such a fan of all of that. I was just sort of in.
Yeah. All I can see are the bad parts of it.
Sure.
There's, interestingly enough, Billy Wilder, whom we'll be talking about for The Apartment. I reread Conversations with Wilder last night, the Cameron Crowe book where he interviews Billy Wilder. And Billy Wilder has the same kind of point of view of any film of his that is not well regarded, where he just doesn't even want to talk about it. He's just like, oh yeah, that didn't work.
Interesting.
I mean, I could go on and on about it for hours, but it was just, it's such a bummer. And every frame of it, I look at it as missed opportunities.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll segue into The Apartment. 1960, of course, Billy Wilder, like you said, Jack Lemmon, Fred McMurray, and
Shirley MacLaine.
Adorable Shirley MacLaine. Yeah. Just so spunky and cute and confident and smart as Kubelik.
Yeah. I only knew her as an older woman.
Yeah, same
basically
here.
Basically terms of endearment or whatever. Mm-hmm. I didn't really know anything about her. So The Apartment was the first time I'd ever seen her as you know, in her prime in a way. I was just like, oh my God, she's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was great. How did this movie, how did it come to you? Like, when did you first discover it?
So I think in 1988 or 89, either my first year or second year of college, I was in an acting class. Basically, my college experience was this. I think I had some morning classes that I had signed up for, like 8 a.m. through noon. And then I had an acting class at 2, and then I had my theater shows at night.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty quickly my schedule became doing theater at night and drinking beer with my friends in their van until 5 a.m., sleeping until noon, and then getting up to do my acting class.
Yeah.
And I basically flunked out of the other classes or canceled them or whatever. But I was in this acting class I think his name was Mark, was the teacher, and he reminds me of Mark Maron.
Oh, really?
Imagine Mark Maron. He was kind of a Mark Maron type. He wanted me to do a monologue where I had to do a lot of action, where I had to do a lot of prop business, because that was whatever was happening that week.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think when you're an actor, like a young actor, you get used to doing stuff like speech competitions or whatever, or monologues where you're like talking to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, that's not real acting. Like when you're on film, you're going to have to be doing a bunch of stuff, you know, like prop business.
Right.
So he said, have you ever seen The Apartment? I had no idea what it was. He's like, I'm going to give you a monologue from The Apartment. I want you to be like cooking spaghetti while you're with a tennis racket while you do it. So, I don't know that I saw the movie before I did the monologue. I basically like got the action I was supposed to do and did the monologue, and I'm sure I sucked. I was terrible. But that was around when I saw it for the first time. Yeah. So it came to me through there, and Jack Lemmon, another guy who I only knew as an older actor.
Right.
Immediately was like, oh man, he's amazing.
Yeah.
Shirley MacLaine, amazing. Fred McMurray, I had only known him through Flubber.
My Three Sons for me and Flubber, yeah.
So, and I had never seen a movie like it either that balanced the tones that it does in the way that it does. I'd never really seen. So it just became, and I didn't really know Billy Wilder or anything like that. I just liked The Apartment.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was all I really knew.
Yeah, I think my entry point for Billy Wilder and this movie was Cameron Crowe, because I was such a fan of his earlier work. And
which ones? The first?
Love Say Anything, loved Singles. I mean, Singles was the confluence of the music. And
I still have never seen it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I love Say Anything and I love Jerry Maguire, but I've never seen Singles.
Wow, that
I've
seems
seen
like
little parts of it on cable every once in a while.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it would age because I haven't seen it in a long time. But yeah, Singles, Say Anything, I love Jerry Maguire, loved Almost Famous.
Didn't really like it for whatever reason.
Really?
Reading the book last night, he's writing Almost Famous while he's writing that book.
Uh-huh.
Because he keeps talking about his project that he's putting off writing.
Yeah.
So he can write this book about Billy Wilder.
Uh-huh.
And I kept going like, oh, I wonder which movie it was. And for some reason, I thought it was Vanilla Sky or something.
Oh, right.
But then he talks about how it's autobiographical. And I was like, oh, this is Almost Famous.
Well, and
so it made me want to rewatch it.
It's funny because the beginning of Jerry Maguire obviously is a complete ripoff of the beginning of The Apartment.
Right.
With quoting the statistics about the size of the earth or the city or whatever.
Right.
And I always knew that, but it didn't really hit me until I watched this last night again, that the attempted suicide, the overdose scene, is straight up Almost Famous.
Oh, okay.
Because the exact same thing happened. Kate Hudson took the overdose. They rushed in there. They put the tube down her throat. And then,
oh, I don't remember.
And then Patrick Fugit is left to sort of care for her, not for 2 days, but he is then in the position that that Baxter was in, of having this sort of caretaker relationship for a moment.
I saw it when it first came out. I've never seen it again, so I don't really remember. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not like Cameron Crowe. He's very much has said, you know, I've taken from or borrowed from Billy Wilder. So
yeah.
I don't think I, like, discovered something.
Right.
I've not outed him.
Right.
But it was when I was living here that Almost Famous came out, saw it at the Vista, read about Cameron Crowe telling the story of trying to get Billy Wilder to be in Jerry Maguire.
He wanted him to be the sports agent.
Yeah, the elder statesman.
Yeah, the mentor figure who kind of comes in every once in a while and is talking to camera about...
Which would have been fantastic.
Yeah.
And he tells a story about bringing Tom Cruise in as the heavy hitter.
Right.
And I remember distinctly he said no, and he said, I could tell by the look on Tom's face that that is not a word that he hears very much.
Yeah. Yeah, he tried twice. He did it by himself, and then he brought Tom in the second time as like, I got to land this.
Yeah.
And Tom Cruise just gave him the whole Tom Cruise pitch, and he was not interested, didn't know who Cameron Crowe is. And
I think
was
I loved
like,
that he said no, you know.
He's just like, I'm not an actor. Get out of here. But then to his credit, watched it and was like, oh, is that the part that I was supposed to do? And loved it.
Really?
And then reached out to Cameron Crowe. Was like, hey, I liked your movie.
Oh, well, that's cool.
And that's how the book came about, is Cameron Crowe wrote an essay about that, about the fact that he was trying to get Billy Wilder to do that part for Rolling Stone, I believe.
Yeah, that's where I read it.
Which Billy Wilder's people sort of saw and said, hey, maybe you should do. And so that whole book, Conversations with Wilder, is... Billy Wilder thought it was going to be for Rolling Stone, thought it was going to be an article. He's like, where's your column? We'll just do this for your column.
Yeah.
And Cameron Crowe kept kind of going, I think this could be bigger. I think it could be a book. He's like, no one wants to read this.
Right.
But then after like the fourth interview kind of settles into it and likes Cameron Crowe so much that it then becomes like a year long thing where they're buddies.
That's so cool.
And they go have dinner a lot, like like Billy Wilder and his wife and Cameron Crowe and his wife. And it becomes like a real friendship, you know? It's
that's
a really
amazing.
Good book. Yeah.
That's so cool. I can't imagine, like, I remember reading that he was in his 90s and he would still go to his office every day.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what he was doing, but...
Cameron Crowe, like... puts in anything you would do. That's what's cool about the book. He's like, in the middle of the interview, he goes, and then he gets a call and then describes what the call is about. And he's just like taking calls where he's like, what? No, I don't have the rights to it. Well, I don't know. Call Paramount. And he slams it down. He's like, wow. I don't know. Someone is asking me if Sunset Boulevard would be good set in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I don't care. Like, uh-huh. Call up Paramount. I don't have the rights to this. And then he complains about, like, the Andrew Lloyd Webber adaptation. Uh-huh. He's like, the set was too bad. Like, it's totally just wow. Cameron Crowe puts in everything that happened, which is really interesting.
That's amazing. Well, and I guess because he had the experience of being a kid ingratiating himself to these bands. Mm-hmm. He must have a real skill for doing that.
Probably, yeah.
If he broke through Billy Wilder's,
I wonder what that is about him. Like, is he just
I don't know
inquisitive and comfortable in those situations, or is
maybe.
He? I mean, is it genuine? Is it something where he's like, you know, is it something that he feels
yeah.
like, oh, this is a thing I can do? Or I don't
he's
know.
He's probably a great listener.
Yeah,
would be my guess. Because when you get in the rooms with the bands and the Billy Wilders, they probably are. It's probably pretty lopsided conversation.
Probably, yeah.
And you have to be good at just shutting the fuck up.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I do. I read the book last night, and yeah, I don't know that Cameron Crowe is ever like interjecting all that much and
yeah.
like offering his. It he eventually gets there. I will say the book. Most of the Billy Wilder stuff that you're interested in mm-hmm. is the first couple of interviews. It's almost
yeah.
like Cameron Crowe is trying to get every question he's wanted to ask,
yeah.
and then the rest of the book is more like. Okay, let's do a deeper dive on this.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It's a fascinating book, though. It's really,
yeah, I'll
it's
have
really
to check that out.
Yeah.
A friend of mine worked on Elizabethtown and said, like, he's also a genuinely good guy.
Oh, cool.
And was great on set and very crew friendly and just a
cool.
nice guy.
Yeah, which is never great. Saw Elizabethtown.
Not great. But my friend was a wardrobe supervisor who was from Elizabethtown and got to work in Elizabethtown on the E-Town movie and got the key to the city. So it was kind of a cool big deal for her.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And in fact, did you say you worked on the Onion movie or no?
A little bit.
I think she worked on that.
I was never on set or okay. anything like that.
So the origin, and you probably know
and
this
by the
stuff.
Way, if anyone's listening, we talked about the Onion movie beforehand.
Oh, right.
I don't watch any of the Onion movie and think any of it was attributed to me.
Okay.
I worked on it after the fact when they wanted to film a brand new movie.
Right.
That maybe used some of the footage from that instead of releasing what they had. They,
uh-huh.
they were like, so I started writing a whole new movie.
Right.
And then it all got shut down. So please don't watch that movie and think I had anything to do with it.
My instinct now, because I'm so binging on your show, is to say, well, wait a minute, is this an episode of Setting the Record Straight?
Thank you. I think it is.
So I'm sure you know the origin of the film, though. Has a few different stories, but I think Billy Wilder said it was a movie from director David Lean. Called
Brief Encounter. Yeah,
Brief Encounter that had just a similar sort of.
So he talks hook. About it in the book where he's basically, because Cameron Crowe is trying to set the record straight.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, was it based on this person in Hollywood?
Which is
a rumor about a guy who whose mistress killed himself
mm-hmm.
in an apartment or something like that. Is it about this story? And he's like, no, I was just watching Brief Encounter one day.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a scene where these two, I think, married lovers are meeting in France. And one of the guys, the guy who's meeting this woman says, oh, this is like a buddy of mine's apartment.
Right.
And Billy Wilder went, geez, I feel bad for the guy whose
yeah.
apartment it is. Like, essentially, they're having sex in his apartment.
Yeah, like that's the story.
And he's got to come back. And these people have just, you know, had sex in his bed.
Yeah.
And he wrote that down in his book, and it was something that he thought of for many years. And the code, the sort of what was permissible in movies, he could never do that
yeah.
idea
until
1960 when
uh-huh.
everything sort of relaxed, and he was finally able to do a movie about this sort of mature subject matter,
mm-hmm.
which is all about, you know, adultery. And it's,
yeah.
it's kind of like a 60s sex romp in a way.
Yeah.
But serious.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's very racy for the time. And I know there were stories of Fred McMurray being accosted in the street and like literally getting hit with a purse.
Yeah. And people saying like, how dare you?
Yeah.
I watch you in these Disney movies and how could you do that?
Yeah.
And Fred McMurray was another guy who was like, I can't do this movie.
Yeah.
Like, Billy, the whole book is filled with like people having heart attacks right before they film. That happened a lot on
oh,
these
really?
Movies, like The Fortune Cookie, and Peter Sellers had a heart attack in the middle of
right.
one of the films and had to drop out after
uh-huh.
he'd filmed for a week. Charles Laughton, I think, also had like a heart attack right before. It was like,
it's because everyone was drinking and smoking
all the time. That's what I started thinking. I was like, God, everyone's fucking having a heart attack.
Yeah.
But Fred McMurray was a guy who was like, I'm not going to do this movie. And I think whoever was doing it dropped out. And Billy Wilder's like, Fred, come to... And Fred McMurray, by the way, Double Indemnity.
Yeah.
He's so... Another Billy Wilder movie. He's so great in that.
Yeah.
And a very quotable movie that my friend and I were constantly... I still say things from it all the time. Uh-huh. Like, that tears it. Uh-huh. one of the funniest stories that Billy Wilder tells about Fred McMurray from The Apartment is there's that scene where he's getting his shoes shined.
Mm-hmm.
And he's flipping a quarter absentmindedly in front of the guy shining the shoes with his thumb, flipping it in the air, almost taunting him with it, like, you may or may not get this.
Right.
And then the guy finishes shining his shoes and Jack Lemmon comes into the frame and Fred McMurray flips him the quarter and goes, thanks a lot. And the shoe shine guy's like, oh, wow, thank you so much.
Yeah.
And he leaves. And for some reason, the quarter wasn't flipping right.
Uh-huh.
And Billy Wilder's saying, like, Fred McMurray is a very cheap guy.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one thing you got to know about him.
Oh, really? So, in real life?
Yeah, in real life. Uh-huh. So he's like flipping this quarter and it won't flip right. And I come over to him and I say, all right, it's okay, Fred. We'll just swap in a 50-cent piece. And Fred goes, I would never tip him 50 cents. I can't act in this scene.
Wow, that's fantastic. That's hysterical.
Yeah.
He's so good in this movie too.
He's so funny in it.
Yeah. And
just playing, a total slime ball.
Yeah. Yeah. Playing a part because, you know, the whole setup, it was, there's so many kind of cool little twists and turns for a romantic comedy. And he, you know, the whole setup is that he has, you think that he is going to be the stand up guy when in fact he's just after that key. And, and there's that great scene with Lemon. Where he's like, you know,
trying to get the key from him and like trying to get him
spelling
to,
it out,
trying to get him to make the leap of, hey, I want the key to your apartment so I can cheat on my wife without having to say it, which for a boss would be,
it would implicate him.
It would, well, it also would like lower his status.
Yeah,
if
true.
He had to, you know, so he's playing very high status in it where he's just like,
yeah.
So you see, I want to give you these Music Man tickets.
Uh-huh. But I want to trade them.
But I want to swap. I want to make a swap.
Yeah.
And then Jack Lemmon's like, well, there's nothing I could swap you for. I mean, I just want to go home and go to bed tonight. So you just give the tickets to someone else.
Yeah.
And Fred McMurray's like, it also says on your reports from your coworkers that you're bright and that you, you know, right. like can make, you know, can make the leap to a certain thing, you know. But it's really interesting about this movie because it does start as like a kind of very comedy sex romp. And
kind of broad
yeah. and you know the idea for it is a great idea, which is basically what if this guy mm-hmm. who has this apartment, all of his bosses wanted to come in and cheat on their wives in his apartment. And so he climbs up the corporate ladder by giving them the key and juggling them all in a very complicated schedule where he has to leave his apartment for hours in the rain and stuff.
Such a great setup.
It's a great setup. And it could have just been that.
Mm-hmm.
So it could have been like a Rock Hudson Doris Day style 60s sex romp with Tony, with Tony, what's his name?
Tony Curtis?
Not Tony Curtis. Who am I thinking of? He would come in and sing on Letterman all the time. Or no, you would come in with Mandy Patinkin. Okay. It'll come to me.
All right.
So it could have just been that. But then the part where it switches into drama is really interesting, which is basically Jack Lemmon gets everything that he wants with Fred McMurray, the slime ball, saying like, hey, I'm going to give you a promotion if you give me your apartment.
Right.
And he goes, great. And I have these Music Man tickets that he swapped me for. I'm going to ask out the girl that I've always liked, the elevator operator. And she goes, oh, yeah, well, I have an appointment, but I'll meet you. I'll meet you there.
Yeah. She agrees to the date.
Yeah. I'll have to do this. I have to do this thing first, but I'll meet you there. I'll be there by 8:30. And you're just thinking, oh, great. Who, you know, and that's one thing that Billy Wilder says, by the way, is like, if you can disguise your plot points.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, that's the sign of how well, how good of a writer you are, is how well you're able to disguise your important plot points.
Yeah.
So she kind of offhandedly says something like, oh, I have to meet someone, but mm-hmm. I'll meet you there at 8:30. So when it then becomes not Jack Lemmon's POV mm-hmm. and it becomes her POV, where you follow her to where she's meeting mm-hmm. and she's meeting Fred McMurray.
Yeah.
And she's basically going to have sex in Jack Lemmon's apartment.
Yeah, man. Brilliant.
That's where it becomes that, because it could have, the premise could have sustained itself where it was just a How to Succeed in Business type.
Yeah, totally.
Type movie. And that's where it deepens and becomes, mm-hmm. it's such a great twist and but a twist that then means this movie is going to have to be serious at parts.
Yeah.
Because it's not treated in this light way of like, oh my gosh, you know, there's going to be slamming doors and Three's
right.
Company type of stuff. It's treated as like, she's just her attitude at the beginning of that. She's upset that he's been fucking around and stringing her along.
Because she's really in love with him, which I think is key to making this work.
Exactly. She's in love with Fred McMurray, mm-hmm. and Fred McMurray is stringing her along and basically, you know, wants to be married and just wants to have sex with someone.
Right.
And it just automatically deepens this movie and turns it now from a lighthearted thing mm-hmm. into a really deep, moving, affecting movie.
Yeah, and it's one of my favorite things in movies where, and as a writer, it's such a tricky thing on when to parse out information to the audience and when to parse it out to the actual characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of my favorite things when the audience is in on something that your protagonist doesn't quite know yet. And it's about how he learns that stuff.
Yeah.
Because when you're watching The Apartment, you know, oh shit, like Kubelik is dating or seeing Sheldrake, but the poor schnook Baxter doesn't know this yet.
Yeah.
So when are we going to find this out?
When's the shoe going to drop?
Yeah. And when is she going to find out
that the apartment that she's boning in is his?
And when's she going to find out that she is just one in a long line? Which he finds out at the greatest office Christmas party of all time.
It really makes you want to move to New York and work in an office.
In 1960.
Like
fantastic.
The scenes that Billy Wilder stages with a lot of people in them,
yeah.
I love those scenes.
Yeah, they look great.
A lot of the movie is just two people talking, mm-hmm. but all those scenes in the bars on New Year's and all that, they just make New York seem so alive and so much fun to be in.
Well, in the huge office with, and I think he used forced perspective.
Yeah, with kids in the back.
It's just crazy.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, all the bar scenes and that party scene. There was something about putting 100 people in a shot that you just kind of don't see as much of anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Well, extras or background artists, they're so expensive.
Yeah.
And it really is a choice that you have to make. And it's a great choice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really makes it feel like a very lived in.
Yeah.
Everything about the movie makes... I mean, they say his address in the movie, so I like immediately...
Oh, that's right.
I went on Google
Maps, what
is it? And it's like... I can't remember the exact address, but it's 57. It's the Upper West Side,
uh-huh.
right? So and he says, I'm a block away from Central Park.
Right.
And so I knew sort of where it was at, but then in the middle of the movie, they say the actual, because Fred McMurray says it to the taxi driver.
Oh, that's
take
right.
me to like 5757
yeah.
or whatever. So I looked it up and that apartment is not there, but it's it just really gives you a great sense of place.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the name of the movie is The Apartment. It was,
it's not the two lovers who are being,
there's something to that. The apartment is like a little character.
Yeah.
And I know they took great pains to make it a little more sort of shabby and lived in than movies did at the time.
Yeah. Movies at the time, Billy Wilder was saying, like, you know, everyone's, he wasn't saying it like this, but in my opinion, everyone's houses in movies were sort of aspirational.
Mm.
People would go to see movies because they wanted to see someone living a better
right.
life than they had, especially in the 30s. You know, which is why everyone's house were these grand sets.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And a movie like Philadelphia Story and stuff like that. Everyone's houses were big and they had staff and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Billy Wilder wanted this to be like a bachelor pad and for it to be realistic. And so it was kind of shabby. It was small.
I mean, it's amazing for dudes like us.
Oh, yeah.
There's like this apartment with a fireplace.
Like a block from Central Park on the Upper West Side. I mean, it was like, you know, it's pretty. But for whatever reason, in the 60s, it was considered a little shabby.
Yeah.
But there's even a poster on the wall that Cameron Crowe and he talk about where Cameron Crowe is like, what is that poster that's like, it's over by his fireplace, uh-huh. I think. And Billy Wilder goes, oh, it's a print from the museum.
Oh.
He goes, basically, in my mind, Jack Lemmon would leave his apartment and mm-hmm. have to walk around the city all the time. So he would spend a lot of times in museums.
Oh, yeah.
So he bought a print from the museum, but uh-huh. because he's a bachelor, he doesn't have anyone to say like, hey, that would look better in a frame.
Right.
You know, so it's just like tacked onto the wall, you know, it's like a touch of glass essentially.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But the tone of it, like you were talking about, is such a magic trick because it borders on that zany kind of thing at the time, especially early on with, the recurring thing of the doctor and the wife is the neighbor.
Yeah, every time you see the doctor sees another girl go into his apartment, he's like, honey! You know, it's like kind of shticky in a way. And it would have been great as just that, but man, the moment that turn happens, then, you know, then suddenly we're in a movie about suicide mm-hmm. that has a very lengthy scene in where a doctor is basically trying to get Shirley MacLaine to regurgitate the pills that she's taken and slapping her in the face.
Just
and
it's slapping the shit out of her.
It's like in real time, essentially just trying to get, you know, he doesn't slap her once and then it fades.
And she's like, I feel
afterwards.
So much better. Yeah.
No, it like is in real time of basically like she could go.
Yeah.
And I just had never seen a movie with straddling those tones, really, other than maybe a movie that I talked about on a different movie podcast, Something Wild.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. That was great.
Yeah. You know, that's kind of straddled the drama and comedy uh-huh. tones.
Is that Jonathan Demme?
Demme, yeah. So I talked about it on Blank Check, which is dealing with Jonathan Demme's filmography.
Uh-huh.
And that I saw in 86, and that was one of my favorite movies at the time because of that tone. And so when I saw The Apartment, I was like, oh, wow, this is doing the same kind of thing. And not a lot of movies do that.
Well, and especially in 1960, tonally, I'm sure it was really divisive back then.
Well, yeah, Billy Wilder was saying that he got a lot of pushback. And,
really?
And a lot of the critics, one of them, I think, famously called it a dirty movie.
Oh, wow.
It just was dealing with more adult subject matter, adultery. Yeah. But aside from that, is also just a movie about, you know, how far you want to go and trying to succeed in life and uh-huh. climb up the corporate ladder. And,
which he was, he didn't, I get the sense he didn't, I think he does tell the story of how it started and he wasn't seeking that out. He didn't offer up his apartment initially, right? Like wasn't the first one.
No, the first one was one of his bosses needed to borrow his apartment for some innocuous reason.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I think the boss was lying to him about why he needed it or whatever.
Right.
And then all of it, and then he couldn't say no after that, because if you say yes to one guy, your other boss says, hey, I need it.
Yeah.
And it just became a thing for him.
Well, yeah. And then it's the outskirts of this movie that play sort of the zaniness of the time. It's always rooted in these great scenes that are pretty realistic and believable between two people, like you were saying. But then on the outside, like when the bosses would bring in the ladies, it was always kind of zany and wacky. And
it's very 60s in a way, with like all these like swinging dames. And Fred McMurray has all this bebop lingo that he's constantly saying. He's you dig? And,
uh-huh.
and at one point he goes, ain't that a kick in the head? And I was like, did the song come first or did?
Oh, or, I don't know.
So I looked it up uh-huh. and they came out at the same time. The Dean Martin song, uh-huh. Ain't That a Kick in the Head, and The Apartment, they both came out in 60, like within months of each other.
Oh, wow.
But Ain't That a Kick in the Head was written for the movie Ocean's 11,
uh-huh.
which Billy Wilder did work on the script for.
Oh, interesting.
Which Ocean's 11 is a terrible movie, but he talks about it in the book about how Frank Sinatra gave him a present. And mm-hmm. he was like, oh, I never liked Frank Sinatra. And Cameron Crowe goes, well, why did he give you a present? He's like, I just did some punch-up work on Ocean's 11.
Right.
So I wonder if like Billy Wilder was like included, ain't that a kick in the head?
Yeah.
That was something that he said or something, which Dean Martin then turned into a song.
Interesting.
Billy Wilder also loved Dean Martin and thought he was the funniest guy in the world.
Well, because Dean Martin could have very well been the Sheldrake character.
Yeah, and he's in Billy Wilder's next movie, 1, 2, 3.
Oh, and I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. Yeah, I have it at home, but I haven't watched it yet.
Well, and they brought back the kick in the head line again later in the movie. I think Lemon references it somehow.
Oh, I don't remember.
Or maybe
that.
It was Shirley MacLaine, something about having been kicked in the head.
Oh, yeah.
And they do that a few times.
Well, it's really interesting because just reading Billy Wilder talk about script writing. It's very, as someone who's like just about to start to write another script, it's very inspiring. And it's also, I watched this movie last night and I was rewatched it and I was like, it's also very intimidating because he just is such an expert at it. And the two things he talked about are, if the stuff you do in the first act isn't paid off in your third act, then you're not succeeding.
Right.
And he is paying off so many things. He's not only paying off lines, he's paying off emotional themes. He's paying off scenes. He like basically the whole third act, like the last 20 lines of the movie are payoffs for something he's set up so expertly from the, and stuff that's so unexpected from like,
well, him donating his body to science as a great lover. He brings that back when he takes the bar lady back.
Right.
Because he starts touting himself. You know, they say I should donate my body to science.
And the last few lines are like Shirley MacLaine innocuously is just talking about her life in the middle of the movie and how she got to where she's got is saying like, well, I wanted to be a stenographer, but I couldn't spell.
Right.
You know, and one of her last lines to Fred McMurray is him going like, what's wrong with you? And her going, well, I'd spell it out for you, but I can't spell.
Yeah.
You know, and Jack Lemmon, when he's talking to Shirley MacLaine about her suicide attempt, talks about his own suicide attempt.
Yeah, it gets heavy.
And how he accidentally shot himself in the knee instead of shooting himself in the head.
Yeah.
And, but he talks about like the knee took me 6 months to get over, but the girl I was over in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know. And he starts, it's such an interesting comment on how someone you feel so close to for a while and can be in love with, a year later, you cannot even ever think of them anymore. And he says, like, I still hear from her every Christmas. She sends me a fruitcake.
Right.
And then they go, hey, let's have the fruitcake tonight. And you think it's just like, oh, wow, that's an interesting comment on life.
Yeah.
And Shirley MacLaine, one of her last lines is, he says, well, what about Fred McMurray? And she goes, I'll send him a fruitcake every year.
Yeah. You
know, it's just like he's constantly paying off everything that he set up. The gun that he talks about, he pays it off in the last scene.
Yep. With the champagne bottle that clearly sounded like a real gun.
Right, yeah. But it's just like such an expert screenwriter move to be like, And I know that sometimes when you see a movie, you can roll your eyes at those kind of payoffs of like callbacks, that, you know, where like someone's calling back someone. But Billy Wilder and what he said about it is if you can disguise it, then they're not true callbacks.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if the thing that irritates people about those types of callbacks is when they're so important in the first act. And then obviously they're going to be called back in the third act. You know what I mean? But
if you
can disguise it where it's just like character and you're not even thinking that that's important and then suddenly it gets called back, it's really, really powerful.
Yeah, you can't call too much attention to it. I think like writer types will notice that stuff, but an audience at large just knows that it feels good and feels right.
And I'm a writer type and the fruitcake one, I didn't even remember it from all my previous rewatching.
Oh, really?
I was just like, fuck.
Yeah.
It's Billy Wilder and IAL Diamond, that's his co-writer.
Uh-huh.
These two are fucking so good at it.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And then another thing on the callbacks, because at the very end of the book, there's like sort of a bunch of random things that Cameron Crowe includes, like Billy Wilder's top 10 tips for screenwriters and stuff. But he also includes this speech that he wrote for Gary Cooper. For at a live event to accept an award, right? And Gary Cooper, I guess, like did a lot of Westerns, I think, or So, but wasn't used to talking all that much. So Billy Wilder writes him this acceptance speech, and he gets up, and the first line is a joke, and he goes, "Well, I bet you all thought that I was going to get up here and have nothing to say except, yup." Uh-huh. And everyone laughs, ha ha. And then he goes through and thanks a bunch of people and all this kind of stuff and has several other funny lines. And then the last line is he goes, "And if you ask me if I've had a wonderful life where I've just worked with the most amazing people, I guess all I would have to say is, yup."
Yep.
You know, and it's just like, fuck. And I wasn't expecting it. Yeah. I'm just like, God damn it. He's like, he's good at disguising something as innocuous when you first hear it. Mm-hmm. And then just, you know, it makes the payoff just really powerful.
And there's so many great little lines. A lot of them are Shirley MacLaine's, but it doesn't feel like super scripty of the day stuff. Like she has the one, scene where I think she first meets Fred McMurray at the Chinese restaurant, and he goes, "I see you cut your hair. You know I like it better long." She goes, "I know. You want me to? Do you want me to leave you a lock to carry in your wallet?"
Yeah.
And that line, and the one about at the end where she says, "Then you end up with Egg Foo Young on your face."
Right.
Like those are great fucking lines.
I mean,
but they don't feel like eye rolly sort of clever lines.
Yeah. He talks about how every scene and every line almost should be something you haven't seen before.
Yeah.
Which the whole movie just feels like, how do we execute this in a way that we've never seen it on screen before?
Uh-huh.
Not only this scene, this joke, this line of dialogue, you know, like we shouldn't be going to movies and watching stuff that was in some other movie, you know?
Right.
And it's hard because when you're a writer, you're like, you're out there supposedly documenting life, but as a writer, you're also this kind of an introspective kind of person who's not experiencing a lot, you know, and a lot of comedy. This is a problem in comedy scripts that you read I read a lot of comedy scripts and you can tell they're all written by like 26-year-olds who have never done anything or never experienced any emotional resonance in life. They're all people who have like watched a lot of The Simpsons.
Oh God.
You know? Uh-huh. And so, I don't know. Yeah. They really had a, and you know, we're not talking about IAL Diamond a lot, but, you know, obviously Billy Wilder's best movies, I think, were written with him. Mm-hmm. So, or most of his best. So, but yeah, I mean, it's just I will say like the craft involved in this movie is a lot of what I respond to.
Yeah.
The emotional themes and stuff, that's very important for Billy Wilder. Mm-hmm. He talks about how you can't even start writing until you know what your theme of the movie is,
right.
You know, which is something that in stuff that we produce, we talk a lot about, mm-hmm. which a lot of comedians don't think about. But for this movie, I think I respond to it in tonally, and I respond to it in terms of craft and just how incredibly well crafted it is. Maybe a little more than the emotional resonance of mm-hmm. it, you know, like I love the end. And it's not too sweet. It's the combination, as they talk about in the movie, the sweet and sour.
Yeah, yeah.
Which they talk about in the Chinese restaurant, uh-huh, you know, which is a metatextual commentary on the movie itself, basically,
absolutely.
Like the sweet and the sour.
Uh-huh.
Because it doesn't end with them kissing.
Right.
Billy Wilder said he didn't think that Jack Lemmon could even pull that off.
Yeah.
Like as a romantic lead, you uh-huh. know, like suddenly taking her in his arms and kissing her.
Yeah.
So it ends with her basically saying, "Shut up and deal."
Just
and
one of the great moments.
You know, it's great. And Billy Wilder goes, "Would they still be together at, you know, like 6 months later?" I don't even know.
I don't either.
I don't even know. But it's more of a personal achievement for them both. More than two people found each other. Like
right.
These are two people who have not had any romantic connection the entire movie. So to have them suddenly kiss would feel weird.
Yeah. I think it would have been the wrong move because she has to go from being legit in love with Sheldrake, being a fractured person. They'd spend, you know, the right amount of time on that, her backstory, mm-hmm. To falling in, or I don't even think falling in love with Baxter at the end, but the hope
to
of
have her fall
in
love would just seem weird because it would seem like, wait a minute, you were just in love with Sheldrake.
Uh-huh.
You can't suddenly right. do a switch. But what's great about it is she suddenly sees a person, a like-minded soul mm-hmm. that has turned his back on and found the strength to be his own person. And
right.
that's what she does as well.
Right.
And so are they together? Do they end up, you know, kissing mm-hmm. ever? Who knows?
Right.
It's not about that, really.
No. I don't think it matters.
Yeah.
He gets to profess his love, which felt real.
Mm-hmm. Because he was.
Yeah, it felt like the right move.
But she just, if she was to say, yeah, I'm in love with you too, stupid, or whatever, it just wouldn't feel right. Yeah.
Yeah, and the way they play out that whole end sequence with her learning about when Sheldrake's telling her, you know, and he said, you know, especially with Kublik, you can't use that apartment.
Right.
And then she runs down the street and All the Anxiety is playing.
And it's basically what Rob Reiner ripped off for
When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everyone ripped it off because it's the best. But it's very, now it feels like a trope, all this stuff. But I don't know, had that been done before in 1960?
I don't know. I think Billy Wilder talked about the champagne cork
mm-hmm.
and how that was ripped off from a previous movie of his
as a gun thing.
Uh-huh. And so he sort of, I think Cameron Crowe brings it up and he's sort of like,
right.
He's very just like, we shot her. He said there's no special lighting or whatever. Cameron Crowe's like, how did you get her to look so like magical?
Yeah.
And he goes, I don't know. We just shot it.
Right. She just looked that way.
Yeah, exactly.
It's such a great ending. It's so perfect because it manages to balance like the whole rest of the movie with the sweet and the sour. It's not overly sweet or sentimental, but just enough
mm-hmm.
to like leave you feeling hopeful and smiling.
Whereas I was watching like The Fortune Cookie, which I'd never seen. So I put that on today, which is Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau in 68.
Mm-hmm.
And that so far, like I'm 45 minutes into it and it's just the sour.
Oh, really?
You know, I don't know. So I wasn't all that into it, but
I haven't seen that one.
It is an interesting balance. You know, not all of Wilder's films are great. And I think he talks about Irma La Douce, which uh-huh. was the reunited Lemmon and McClane
right.
Wilder team. And he's just like, didn't work. It's terrible.
Yeah. Jack Lemmon was so good though.
Yeah.
Days of Wine and Roses. And like, he had such a range.
Yeah.
He was just one of the greats.
Some great physical comedy in it.
Yeah. He goes a little broad. Like the stuff with the bowler hat is just so cute and funny.
Yeah. The nasal spray squirt is so funny. And that was improv, I guess, from Jack Lemmon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that was one of the few times Wilder let him improv, I think.
And one of the few kind of sort of broad slapsticky things.
Yeah.
Like that overt, but for some reason
it really works.
It's
really
does.
Good. I feel like I've tried to rip it off a few times.
Oh, really?
And
then he squirts the flower too at a certain point.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun.
Wilder also said that Lemmon would come to set having like read through the pages with his wife the previous night and go like, I was talking to my wife and we had this idea. We just thought it would be like better if we did this. And Wilder would go like, nah. And Lemon would go, that's what I was saying. It's a terrible idea. And he would never bring it up again.
Right.
And Wilder was like, that was what was so great about him is he wasn't like an actor who felt like he needed to defend his ideas
yeah.
and make sure they got in the script or whatever.
Uh-huh.
If I didn't like it, he would just
roll with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is so funny. But speaking of ripping things off, there's one scene that I have ripped off several times
mm-hmm.
and in scripts. And it ended up being in the Ferns movie that I just directed. So,
which I just saw a few weeks ago.
Okay. So the end with Fred McMurray, the final Jack Lemmon, Fred McMurray scene
mm-hmm.
where Fred McMurray says like, hey, I'm taking Shirley MacLaine to your apartment tonight to have sex.
Right.
And if you don't like it, then, you know, you're out of a job
mm-hmm.
essentially. So Wilder and I.L. Diamond very early in the movie set this up with Ray Walston.
Mm, who was great in this.
Who's really great.
And super broad.
Yeah. but very early in the movie, when it still is like a light comedy, Ray Walston says, Hey, Jack Lemmon calls up Ray Walston and says, hey, you were supposed to leave the key under the mat to my apartment. Mm-hmm. And Ray Walston goes, didn't I? He goes, no, the key, you left a key, but it's not the key that works.
Right, the executive washroom.
And he goes, oh, I should have let, oh, I must have left the executive washroom key. Huh. And that's just like, you view it as a viewer as, oh, that's a funny complication, but mm-hmm. it's not important, right? So then in the final Fred McMurray scene, Fred McMurray says to him, hey, you need to give me that key mm-hmm. or else you're out of a job.
Yeah.
And he has mentioned like, hey, what do you think of the executive washroom in your right. new office? And just casually mentions it uh-huh. as, and you think it's, as a viewer, again, you're just like, oh yeah, these are all the perks that he gets.
Yeah.
And Jack Lemmon wrestles with this decision because mm-hmm. he's in love with Shirley MacLaine and then, you know, pushes the key across to Fred McMurray and gives up.
Yeah.
We think. And then goes into his office and Fred McMurray has won.
Uh-huh.
And we think, man, that sucks that Jack Lemmon didn't stand up for himself, but I understand he'd lose his job.
Yeah.
Jack Lemmon goes into his office. He's tidying up. Fred McMurray comes in and says, hey, this is the key to the executive washroom. And Jack Lemmon goes, yeah, I'm not going to be needing it anymore because you can take this job and shove it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's such an amazing, not only finally calling back this stuff that was planted in the first act, mm-hmm. but it is one of the great like fake outs to me in
yeah,
movies
totally.
Of a character you think is doing the wrong thing mm-hmm. and he's actually doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So I try to rip it off in almost every script I write.
Really?
And so when we were making the Ferns movie, we ended up having one last final day right before it came out to shoot a totally new ending, along with a bunch of other scenes. So, that we just needed to get. So, I like 2 days before shooting, I was basically had worked out with the studio what scene they would agree to in broad strokes of like, okay, so Zach, if you haven't seen the Ferns movie, who cares? This probably won't spoil it for you, but who cares about the plot? But it's Zach basically has sold out in Hollywood and is now doing cheesy talk show interviews like right. you see Fallon do or whatever.
Yeah, and has left his team behind.
And his team says, hey, this isn't you. Come on back to North Carolina mm-hmm. and go back to doing the show the way it should be done.
Yeah.
And he goes, you really want me to give up on all my dreams? And meanwhile, the network executive is over here saying, Zach, we need to do promos.
Right, right.
And they say, come on back with us. And he just looks at them, shakes his head and walks and follows the lady into the studio.
Uh-huh.
And then it cuts to his crew lonely going back to North Carolina. And he suddenly appears and he's like, where are you going? I just went back to get my ferns.
Right.
he's like, you think just because I didn't answer you and I silently walked into the studio without telling you what I was doing, I wasn't coming with you guys? Of course I'm coming with you guys. And that is a direct ripoff of that scene in the apartment.
Oh, just, man. So great.
Yeah.
Are you going to keep trying to do that?
Yeah. Well, it's such a good, move. It's such a good screenwriting move. If I can do it, then I can.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Know. Yeah.
All right, man, you got anything else?
I don't think so. I mean, it's great.
Yeah.
Watch it, enjoy it.
It's kind of a perfect movie.
Yeah.
I guess the one thing I did want to mention was the other thing that they, just as writer-wise, writer-wise, that thing that he kept doing with using wise on the end of something else.
So this is something interesting that you might not know, but so a lot of the sophisticated characters who are Jack Lemmon's bosses keep mm-hmm. saying something wise. They keep adding wise to each of their things. So like, so apartment wise, how are we, you know, and it's meant to like sort of imply a sophistication or a fast talking type of guy mm-hmm. that Jack Lemmon wants to emulate. And he starts sort of talking that way, which then of course they pay off at the very end with Shirley MacLaine saying, I guess that's how it crumbles cookie wise, you know,
so great.
Which is her finally like, telling Fred McMurray, I'm not with you anymore. I'm now thinking of Cece Baxter, Jack Lemmon.
Yeah.
It's so great. It pays off.
Fantastic.
But the very last, if you read the script, the very last line is not shut up and deal. There's a scene description line that says, and that's all there is story-wise.
Wow. Fuck, that's great.
It's incredible.
Yeah, and so that's just for the actors and...
That's just for anyone reading the script.
Yeah.
That's how good they were. They were putting in jokes in their...
That is amazing.
In their descriptions.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
I got to read that book.
Yeah, it's great.
All right, thanks, man. This is a big treat for me. I appreciate you taking the
time. Appreciate you having me on. Love talking about movies.
Awesome. Thanks. All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that. That was so much fun. I had to kick the dust off a little bit. It's been a while since I've done one of these. It was great. He was a good dude and so generous with his time. It was so fun to talk to someone that kind of came into the podcast scene along the same time that we did with Stuff You Should Know. Even though his backstory pre-podcasting is far, far different from mine. He was a kindred spirit and a great guy, and I appreciate him making all this time for me. Really cool to hear him talk about The Apartment and the fact that he watched it the night before and read up on the Billy Wilder stuff. It's always appreciated when a guest really takes their time to come in well-armed, and he certainly was. So thanks to Scott. Thanks to you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time. Go out and see The Apartment if you haven't. Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.